We're always one no away from a yes.
Yep.
It's just a matter of outlasting the no's until that yes happens, because it will happen. It does for everyone. I think most people just quit too soon and they're only shy of a few no's until they reach that yes.
Welcome to the Fuel Hunt Show.
What's going on, Eagles? I'm Joey and this is the Fuel Hunt Show. I got Drew here to my right this time. Mm-hmm. Usually you're to my left, to my right.
You know what I realized? I shouldn't have wore a jacket, but now we're like really, we're really twinning.
Well, at least it's not the same color.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yours is definitely a step up from mine.
Right. All right. Well, anyway, you're on my right because on my left, we have a special guest today. I could use many, many words to describe Lyman. I will try to paint the picture of all of the things that you are: world champion fighter, entrepreneur, actor, servant to humanity, mental health advocate. What else? Philosopher. I'm going to go with philosopher. JT, like Josh from Consequence of Habit called you that. And I absolutely loved it. But also friend to me, you know, over the past year, and somebody that I really respect. So welcome everybody to the show, Drew. Yeah. Lyman. Good.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah. Of all the things you colorfully described me as, you know, the one I take to heart the most is friend. Because I think beneath the surface of all those accolades and things, I'm just another human being, just like any other guy, you know, humbled and grateful to be here today.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for making the trip down with Mika. You know what I mean? I know it's not a long ride, but it's raining today, a whole thing. So making the trip down to HQ, we appreciate. It's funny because before we started the show, you know, I was going through all of those different ways I was going to describe you. And I mentioned to you that it was almost... we've been friends now for a while, and it was almost embarrassing how little I knew about your achievements as a fighter. We had a little conversation about identity and you saying, you know, look, like, yes, I'm all of those things, but at my core, I am who I am. You know what I mean? So I do want to touch a little bit on fighting,
of course,
during the show, mainly because the few want to know about your come up. And when I say come up, we say come up on the show a lot. Really what come up means is what you overcome to become who you are today. And fighting has been a big part of your life, right? On the journey. Yeah. So we'll touch on it a little bit. I've had the opportunity to join you for dinner in New York, right? So you are a New Yorker.
Yes.
Yeah.
New Yorker at heart.
At heart. Yeah.
Born and raised in East Harlem, the projects of, you know, old East Harlem. And those are my humble beginnings. Yeah. Very proud. Driving on the way up here actually gave me a little bit of, you know, down memory lane.
Nostalgia.
A bit of nostalgia driving up here and seeing the, you know, the buildings and a lot of it kind of just reminiscent of where I first started from. I'll never pretend to be someone who came from, like, you know, riches or royalty or from greatness. I take pride in having come up from nothing and very little and from the, you know, very poor. I never claim prosperity in my lineage in life. I think for me, it's just more about hard work, the dignity of hard work, as you guys always describe, and just literally fighting for what I have.
Yeah, literally and figuratively, right? Like, I've never understood people that accomplish something great and then kind of discard their humble beginnings. Like, they only want to be associated with their greatness and not where they came from, when really where they came from helped build who they became. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's sad because part of what we do also, for me, for example, and I could give different avenues of, you know, going back and trying to give thanks and appreciation to things. One would be my Hispanic heritage, you know, that I could say, like, look, I'm someone who statistically, you know, speaking, who came up from, you know, an area very much full of drugs, violence, gangs, could have just fallen to that statistic easily. But after, you know, my success and everything I've accomplished, I'm never going to act like I don't come from that. As a matter of fact, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to go back and be like, listen, anyone else who's Hispanic, who's coming up from the projects, who thinks that they can't accomplish or do anything, I did it, and I'm not special. I'm just someone who saw something special in myself. It started first with believing in yourself, mm-hmm. to then saying, like, I could get out of this. I don't need to land as another number on a statistic. I could be one of the few, mm-hmm. and I could accomplish many great things just so that I could look back at the people who think they can't do it, yeah. simply to tell them that they can.
Yep. You can fight for it. Absolutely. You can fight for it, like, you know, figuratively and literally. That's the crazy thing about pain. Like, it was not easy. Let's talk a little bit about what it was like for you growing up there. I've got to imagine it was not easy and it was painful, right? That's the crazy thing about pain, because pain can actually be comfortable. You can sit in that pain where you grew up and your upbringing and be comfortable in it and become a victim and say, statistically, I'm not supposed to make it out of here. I'll just wallow in this. You know what I mean? Like, I have an excuse not to fight for greater. Or you can choose a different type of pain, break out of the comfort zone, and fight to change this statistic. You know what I mean? Or the interpretation of who people thought that you would be.
It's funny because just recently I was having a conversation with one of my students at my school talking about, you know, no one really knows happiness until they're met with more. And looking back at my childhood, as far back as I can remember, mm-hmm. as a child looking around at my environment, I didn't really see it at the time as painful or as, you know, not having enough of or anything, because I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
I just knew what I knew. To me, that was my more. Mm-hmm. But you don't know that until your, you know, your vision gets further down, you know, expanded down to horizons in life. And then you realize, like, there is more.
Yep.
Then all of a sudden you're greeted with pain. The pain, not of what you have, but the pain of what you don't have yet. And so mm-hmm. growing up, I didn't know any better. It was just like, you know, I'm just some punk kid getting, you know, fights. Mm-hmm. I always felt different from my environment. It's one thing I could say that at least I'm thankful to my younger self for, is to not fall in line and to not just, you know, be another sheep and, mm-hmm. you know, amongst the flock. Mm-hmm. But I think for me growing up, what was more painful was more of the things to do with family.
Yeah.
Things that were very much behind closed doors and things that no one really knew about, nor I ever spoke about until mm-hmm. I was older. Mm-hmm. But the pain of my environment was more of just a condition. It was more of a just an everyday life thing for me. I never mm-hmm. knew any better. So, you know, going back to that conversation I had with my student, it just reminded me how we only feel unhappiness when we see more or know that there's more. And yeah. if you look at people in third world countries, children who play with rocks, who are hanging out like by streams of dirt water, that's their happiness.
Yeah.
So in the midst of that, during that time, it wasn't so much that it was either painful or not painful. It was just more of, it was just my circumstance of life. That was my sure. way of living.
It was your reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was your reality. You know, you mentioned gang violence, drugs, right? Like, oh, yeah. if anybody's familiar with Spanish Harlem, they probably understand that at surface level, right?
Yeah. All you got to say is East Harlem or Spanish mm-hmm. Harlem,
yep.
Jefferson Projects, Johnson Projects.
Yep.
You know exactly what's up, you know, which gangs and everything.
Yeah, you know. For sure. You mentioned fighting as a kid, mm-hmm. right? I know a little bit about those fights. The few probably so don't.
Yeah. Probably don't. Stories about you. You got a reputation about you. You know?
I got my ass beat growing up. We have a swear jar. Every time I swear, I have to put a 20 in it. Right. And then the 20s go to Josh over a Consequence of Habit as a donation. So fresh out of 20s from the previous shows we filmed today. So I write me down. So let's get into some of those instances of fighting as a kid for you when you were in school, and then how that led you into fighting as a career or finding martial arts. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
So I had no recollection of wanting to get into martial arts, to be honest. It mm-hmm. was all through the thought process of my mother, who got me involved much later. But long before that, when I say fighting, what I mean was more, I don't want to throw more dollar bills, but I'll contribute this one to JT, but pretty much beating the shit out of bullies mm-hmm. growing up, because it was one thing that really bothered me. I can't tell you as a kid just how much it boiled my blood seeing people pick on young, weaker people, yeah. You know, and I've seen it, especially, you know, in the schools in that area where I grew up in, there's a lot of bullying. So I threw caution to the wind, didn't really care for the education system to begin with. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was of no bother to get kicked out or expelled from school for beating up a bully. If I see someone picking on another kid, you know, whether mm-hmm. I like the kid or not, didn't matter. I at least use that as a opportunity to vent and release a lot of rage and hate and anger that I grew up with mm-hmm. to at least release it on someone I thought was deserving of it.
Yeah.
So those were my fights growing up. And I was pretty much throughout the years kicked out of schools. I think if I remember correctly, 5 schools that I've been kicked out of so far.
Yeah.
I got a little bit
so
of
far.
Yeah, rap sheet.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But, funny enough, I grew up with a Catholic school upbringing.
Yeah.
Then my first school getting kicked out of was from a Catholic high school, LaSalle Academy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, fighting was more about not fighting in the environment, but more about fighting for others.
Sure.
When you got kicked out of LaSalle Academy, was it for fighting a bully for that specific reason?
Yeah. So there was there was this kid. I was on a track team in LaSalle Academy, and there was another person who was on the team with us. His name was Patrick, big, tall kid who was just chucking pennies. Like, he had a handful of pennies mm-hmm. out of his pocket randomly. He was just throwing pennies at the back of this kid's head. It looked like, I don't know if you guys ever seen Dexter's Laboratory, spitting image, protector and everything. And he was throwing pennies at him, and I'm just standing there watching this. I'm like, the kid would not even move. He was so frightened and just felt so paralyzed by wanting to stand up for himself that he just stood there and took getting hit in the back of the head with these pennies. And I'm like, in my head, like, why isn't he, you know what I mean? So I mumbled something under my breath. The kid told me something to the effect of, you know, mind my own business or whatever. And back then I was, contrary to what it seems now, with very composed and calm, you know, that I have. I was the opposite growing up. I was very wild. I wouldn't give warning shots to anyone. I would just walk up to people and just hit them and attack people. Yeah. I never said this out publicly, but I used to have violent outbursts mm-hmm. growing up as a child. And that was the start of it for me. I just walked up to the kid, Patrick, just threw one mean right hand, the hardest I could throw it, broke his tooth.
Damn.
And then I didn't get suspended or expelled yet because I had the dean of discipline of the school, I don't know why, but always had some kind of soft side to his heart towards me. And he said, look, you can't be doing things like this. Obviously, it's not good.
Yeah.
But I see something in you as well. I see that you're just a troubled kid. You have problems. Like, he was kind of almost like feeling sorry for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he gave me a second chance. Then I got threatened by this other kid, some Italiano wannabe, who was like saying he was going to threaten me after school. Nothing to it. Long story short, he said he was going to wait for me after school with a bunch of like friends of his.
Yeah.
I waited after school, didn't see anyone. I just saw him walking home. So I snuck up behind him. I remember stomping him out on a freaking in front of a deli, you know, and the dean of discipline pulled me in. He was like, listen, my hands are tied now. I wish you good luck in everything you do in life. I see there's something there, but I also see that you're troubled and you have some problems that you need to help, you know, get fixed. And I hope you can resolve them down the road in life, you know. Yeah. And that was the end of my Catholic school years, you know.
Hell yeah.
After that, man, it was Washington Irving High School.
Repeating itself. Same.
Yeah, it was
same
just
thing.
Same cycle. It was just different bullies.
The irony in it is, like, you know, we all have something in our past, right? That causes us to beat a bully up, or maybe sometimes causes us to be a bully. Like, the irony in the situation is those people that were bullying, they probably had something deep down too that was causing that behavior. It was just like a different manifestation of it, and like, you know, both need to be healed. But at the time, I support what you were doing.
That's how I feel about everyone on social media nowadays. I mean, I feel like we find ourselves just constantly hating on one another. Like, everyone to get likes and comments is throwing shade at someone else or putting someone else down. And even the people in the comments are just so aggressive and just mean, for lack of a better word. And I just, whenever I'm reading those comments or even comments on our post sometimes, I'm like, I hope your day gets better. I hope you heal from whatever you're going through.
Yeah.
And people don't even take that. They get offended by you even saying that or wishing that on them, because like, oh, fuck you. Like, what? Well,
because they want to fight. They're expecting. Yeah, exactly. They push you so that you could push them back. Mm-hmm. But if they push you and you hug back,
mm-hmm.
or you're like, what's going on? Yep. I know there's something there. Talk. Yeah. It's like it throws them off. And I think it forces someone who might have pushed, you know, metaphorically speaking,
mm-hmm.
in a position where now they have to be vulnerable.
Yep.
And that's where the problem lies, is that it's easy to hide pain with anger. It's easy to hide it. You know, personally speaking, it's very easy to also hide pain with, you know, violence or acts of like making fun of other people, because mm-hmm. it distracts from the attention on them.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's true what they say, like hurt people hurt people.
Yep. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm on a campaign of life now, in a phase in life where I'm also realizing that healed people heal people as well.
Oh, absolutely. You absolutely. Know? So well said, man. That's the truth. So, you know, you're making your way through a couple of high schools because of the fighting. At some point, your mother suggests martial arts, right?
She suggested several activities to try to get my demons out.
Yep.
So I was always into art at the time,
mm-hmm.
but I got locked up in a psychiatric unit because part of my art and what I'd write in a journal mm-hmm. got found by an authority from the school that I was attending at the time and deemed it necessary to, address it to, the hospital. And after evaluation, given my history, skipping over a lot of other stories too about, you know, self-inflicted harm and things I used to do to myself back, you know, in my childhood, Dave locked me up. It kept me in a psych ward, you know.
Yep.
And I was on antidepressants growing up. I was on a lot of medications. I was seeing a lot of therapists.
What age is this around? So you're still high school age?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
My memory of childhood in that time of my life is a little foggy.
Sure.
But a lot of it was just blurs with every occasional random glimpses of clarity,
mm-hmm.
of moments that I remember that stuck out to me. Mm-hmm. And one of them was being in a hospital. Another one was from the antidepressants I was taking. I overdosed on a whole vial of it.
Yeah.
You know, almost out of humor, because these things that were in this vial, these pills were supposed to be like a magic pill to make me happy. It was not making me happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, fuck it. And I just downed the whole thing, down the hatch,
mm-hmm.
and ended up in a hospital. I had to get my stomach pumped. So there was already, and all this in the same hospital that I was also born in. So I had all my records there.
Yeah.
When I got out of the psychiatric unit, I remember for the first time I felt this anger that felt different than the anger I felt before. It wasn't towards people any longer. It was more towards life, towards myself,
mm-hmm.
and towards the desire for change. And I remember one of the things I said to myself was that I can't rely on these external things to make me be who I see myself as this person that's burning inside of me. You know that yearning that you have, you know that feeling. Right. You wouldn't be doing what you guys are doing right now if you weren't chasing that.
Yep.
That I was feeling then, I didn't know how to describe it, was just calling, and it was like begging to just like rip out of my flesh. And so I started to try to make some changes. Mm-hmm. One of them was just getting rid of therapists because they weren't doing anything for me.
Mm-hmm.
The other was getting rid of all my medications because all it was giving me was terrible side effects. I was getting locked jaw, muscle spasms. I was very, if you've seen like how white I was, very pale and pacey and just terrible. I felt like a zombie. I wasn't mm-hmm. really myself. So I got rid of all that. And then my mom saw that I was actually trying hard, and she saw I was struggling too. So that's when, you know, the life-changing idea came about, and she said, why don't we do martial arts? I'll do it with you, because she knows how I think. I don't do things unless it involves her or something. And she was like, let's do it together as a hobby. So we did our research, started training.
Had she done anything like that up until this point previously?
Not at all. No,
that's awesome.
Amazing.
She's crazy like that. She'll just throw herself in any situation. You know, my mom, she's very unconventional. She's fly with the wind. Let's just be free. Like, you know, like she's ride or die. She's that type of woman that will do anything for her children, you know, for myself and my two sisters. But she said, let's go train martial arts. We did our research, looked up the nearest one to us, and the best one that we had found still to this day is the best. It's just my heart, my family now. It's Tiger Schulman's. That's where, you know.
So that's where, so you started with, you've been Team Tiger Schulman since the very beginning.
My whole life, yeah. That's the day I died. That's my loyalty.
Fellow teammate, brother.
Yeah.
Hanging out with me right there.
That's it. Representing.
Do you have the same, Taekwondo, right, is Tiger Schulman's?
No. Mixed martial arts now.
Okay.
So it traditionally went, for many years, it was traditional martial arts. Okay. Right? They had katas and forms, and then it was more like, it wasn't Taekwondo, but it was karate.
Okay.
And the style which Tiger derived from was Kyokushin karate, which is his origins.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, that changed. I got into it at the point when they changed and started adapting to mixed martial arts.
Oh, really?
They've always been in mixed martial arts. They've been, you know, doing jiu-jitsu, kickboxing, and other things. But the model of martial arts that they were teaching at the schools back then was more traditional.
Got you. Okay.
Do you have the same, would it be a sensei or a professor? What do you guys refer to them as?
Coaches. We have a team of coaches now.
You know, do you have the same one you did when you came on?
Yes, sir.
Trained
him yesterday morning. You know, it's one thing about me is I'm a loyal dog, sometimes to a fault.
Yeah.
But, you know, I plant flags and I stay there until, you know, the flag is no more or the ground crumbles or the earth dies, you know.
So your relationship with him has to be.
They're like fathers to me because I never had a father growing up. And they took me in from the streets and changed me into the man that I am today. They helped pave the way. They didn't do it for me. They just gave me the tools.
Sure.
And they proved that if I truly wanted it, I'd have to go after it. But at least they kind of laid out the map for me to become that man.
So,
and well, okay.
Different location, or is it the location that you now own?
So it's that location has become the spot that I own now. It's on 19th Street in Manhattan, lower area of Manhattan.
Okay.
But that school has since closed down, and we reopened a few blocks down the road. That is my location now.
Okay, I got
you. So essentially almost taking over the Manhattan school that I started in when I first started training.
Amazing. Is there a point where your mom splits off? Like you start taking to... The training?
She's still training.
Oh my gosh. I was gonna say like plot twist. She's been fucking badass, like black belt.
She's amazing. Been a little MIA because she's been busy with you know, property and things in Puerto Rico. But
yeah,
you know, mom, if you're watching, get your butt back in training.
Is there a belt system in your guys? Okay. Yeah. So is she like the highest ranking belt?
There? She's up there. She's a green belt, high green. But it's also belts are merited by time and consistency. And you know, she's been consistent, just as of late just been busy with traveling and with life and you know, things.
I was gonna say too, it sounds like your coaches knew to provide you with the tools, but they're not going to do the work for you. And I think that's a great way of teaching, a way I try to teach my son, right? I'm not going to step in and do things for him all the time, but where I feel as though in today's society, a lot of parents especially do that for their kids. They literally do the work for them and solve their problem. And you always said, I'm not going to steal your problems away. And that's one thing that stuck with me always, is I'm not going to steal your problems from you. And being someone that practices a martial art and jiu-jitsu, a lot of people, there's a lot of hate on the traditional aspects of martial arts nowadays. Like, everybody just wants to like do jiu-jitsu and have fun, like 10th planet style, I guess. But like, it's just it's not a traditional way of the martial arts, but I think there is the school we go to at Gracie Baja, there's a bit of tradition still left in the martial arts, where I think to apply that to your story, I think that's maybe what helped you change, right? Like the martial arts in what they were derived from.
Not just the training, but the values.
Yeah.
Right?
That martial arts definitely saved my life. It changed it 100%. I don't know where I would be if it wasn't for martial arts.
Okay.
So the adaptation of the tools and the instruments to success, they were laid out, but they weren't, you know, like my coach never grabbed the hammer for me or the drills and then, you know, power tooled his way through my life. He just showed me how to use it. He backed off and he'd watch what I do with it.
And then course correct.
Mm-hmm. There's a condition and a very beautiful one that occurs when you allow someone discomfort. And that brings me back to one of the questions I had asked you when you were on the Good Theory podcast, relevant to how you raise children, you know, mm-hmm. your kid.
Yeah.
And how much discomfort will you allow for her to go through until, you know, like, all right, daddy's got to step in, but you kind of let her go through it for the conditions of change, for the conditions mm-hmm. of the beauty of transformation that occurs in discomfort.
Yeah.
So there's definitely something there. There's a formula and it's not a secret. We all know that, you know, when you want it bad, you'll figure out.
Yeah.
Most people in life who find problems, it would be interesting to find out in a made up world. Let's imagine this.
Yeah.
If someone literally put a gun to them and said, if you don't do this thing that will give you success in life, like I'm going to.
9 times out of 10.
You know,
they'd solve the problem. I'm telling you right now.
Is that we create our own problems and we could also create our own solutions. It's just when we live up here,
mm-hmm.
it's the worst place to live in. Hell is in our heads.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Thank you for reminding me. I remember saying that a lot in the beginning of our journey. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to steal this problem.
Because
when I reflected on my own life, the things that made me feel the most self-worth were problems I solved by myself. And not saying that I didn't have a mentor there or someone that showed me the tools or how to use them, but they showed me. They said, hey, look, I think this is a tool you can apply in this situation. And then they walked away.
Yeah.
And I had to solve the problem. Nobody stole it from me. And even the wave of entitlement that we're seeing in society today, it's because for good reasons, or with good intentions, mm-hmm. a lot of problems were stolen from us mm-hmm. as youth.
It's funny that he asked you that on that podcast, because that's a constant question I ask myself and reflection I have is, my son comes home from school to a loving family, gets kisses and hugs, gets waking up with cuddles, gets cuddled to bed. And I grew up in a much different type of environment, right? Like, my product of divorce, there was some domestic like disputes and just a lot of trauma that happened that I believe caused me to be the person I am today, because I mm-hmm. overcame and learned how to deal with that trauma and that adversity. So I always think, like, how the hell is he going to turn out if I don't manufacture some adversity into his life? So I do make him do hard things. He's already cold plunging, he's all like doing workouts every day. He knows like there's work that has to be done, and I feel bad every time I tell him he has to do this hard thing, because I want to just make it easy for him, but I know I can't.
No, you can't. You're right. I mean, some of it nowadays manufactured, because there's so much comfort, you know.
It's controlled pain, controlled discomfort. It's like mm-hmm. just having levers and dials on the level of discomfort, enough to not break them, but enough to make them.
Yep. When I was on your show, I mentioned like trying. Like, I keep it real simple with my girls. It's like, you have to try. And even Eddie spoke about trying when he was on the show. Eddie Alvarez was a guest on our show a little while ago. And he said he tells his kids the same thing, like, try. Yep. So when they come to me, and it's natural for a kid, because your child knows you have the solution, right? So when your child comes to you and says, hey, I need help, or they are coming to you for the solution, you've got to say, how many times have you tried? Like, that's my thing. I go back to Everly or Cecilia and I say, how many times have you tried? Mm-hmm. And there's like a threshold, like there's a number and it's high, you know? And I'll give carrots, like I'll give clues sometimes, but I will never steal a problem.
Yeah.
You know, it sets them up for a life of entitlement and waiting to be saved instead of them saving themselves, which the age that our kids are at, saving yourself is going to have a whole nother meaning by the time that they get to the age that we're all at right here.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
And I do love martial arts and wrestling too so much, because I was never a great wrestler, a standout wrestler, but being in the room and getting my head bounced off the mat repeatedly taught me so much about life. Like, even today, like, I'm not the best jiu-jitsu practitioner,
mm-hmm.
but I show up every day because I love the pain and that feeling post training where you're just like dead inside, but you really you've been
because
reborn.
You gave it all.
You've been reborn. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And having him in that he's at seven already experiencing, and there's times he's caught in triangles or getting his arm ripped off. Like the other day, it gets uncomfortable let it happen. But I have to sit there and let it happen. You have to know when to tap too, because I told him last night, like, you can always tap early, tap often, because you can always train again. And but you're humbling yourself in doing so.
Yeah. Humbling, I think, is the key word. I think we obviously romanticize the idea of the win, you know, the submission, the knockout, the favorable aspects of martial arts, of course.
Sure.
But there's a part of that formula that is not as sexy and it's not as humbling or, you know, cool as losing, you know, quote unquote losing. And in martial arts, that's why it's humbling, is because you're going to fall. You're going to tap. You're going to get hurt. You're going to get hit, you know. Of course, not hurt in a way where it's like bad hurt, but I mean, like, you're going to get touched. I tell my students all the time, like, everybody has a number. And I always ask my students at the end of class, what does that mean? And they know by now, the ones who've trained with me for many years, I say the number of jabs I throw for me to get good at it is not the same that it will take you to get good at it, for you to get good at it. We all have a different number. Mm-hmm. Our number just means how many times we have to fall before we finally get it. So failure is a process. It's part of the formula. And I tell my students all the time as well, like, if you don't fall, how do you learn to stand? And you need that. That's why martial arts is one of the most transformative, most transcendental things that there is in this life, because it's honest, it's raw. There's no cheating it. There's no winning it over with any money. There's nothing other than what you put in is what you get out. Mm-hmm. Sweat, blood, and tears. That's the currency of growth in that sport.
Yep.
That was also, absolutely. It was real quick on to that point. This is a much less elegant way of saying this, but I heard a story on Instagram or whatever. It was like, when a baby falls, when they're trying to walk, they don't just say, okay, I'll quit now. I'll stop trying to walk now. They stand up as many times as it takes.
Oh my God,
to walk. And when you think about that, it's like, you're like, oh my God. Like that.
Yeah, even like JJ told us, you know, a baby will fall 20 times in 1 hour while learning to walk, right? And now in our 30s and 40s, we fail once and we're like, oh, it's over. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to quit now. It doesn't, it's not how we're engineered.
That's so
we think we shouldn't lose for some reason. Yeah. Like, we just, everything we try should just turn to gold.
I've told my students that actually, it's a known fact. Quitting is actually an acquired characteristic of humans. We're not born to quit, because if we did, as you guys, you know, just stated, a child who falls, they're not just, I'm not going to walk for the rest of my life. They're going to learn, and you know, we are born resilient. Physiologically also speaking, we unlearn things. For example, breathing, even how we breathe, we unlearn how to breathe. We stomach breathe as babies, animals stomach breathe. We chest breathe as adults, because we're introduced, you know, as we grow older, to discomfort, to pain, to adversity. So it is up to us to educate ourselves in how to breathe, metaphorically speaking, and how not to quit. You know, if you fall, keep walking like you did as a child. I think we just forgot that process.
Yeah, we unlearned it. We learned worst habits. Yeah. You know,
you got nasal breathing. That's why.
What's that?
Nasal breathing. So you gotta learn how to nasal breathe.
Yeah, there you go.
Tape your mouth shut.
Meditation helps with that.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. Taping your mouth, and you know.
Yeah. You ever see a baby squat though? Like, they have perfect squat form, and then somehow
it's like my squat form.
Somehow when we're adult, we aren't able to squat perfectly anymore. Yeah. Because we unlearn those good habits that we've always, always had.
As your good friend JT says, you know, consequence of habit.
Yeah.
There are good habits, bad habits, but there's also unconscious habits, and they form in a very specific age of our developmental years without us even knowing. And then we arrive as adults and we're like, wait, why does this keep happening? Why do I, blah, blah, blah. Why, you know, you're asking yourself why, you just forgot when you shaped and formed those habits that created who you are today as a person. We are just basically a series of habits, routines, and rituals.
Yep. All the way down to, you know, self-sabotage and things like that. It's things that we learned, you know what 100%. I mean? When we were younger. Let's talk a little bit about, and we don't have to touch on, you know, your whole career, but let's talk a little bit about the you mentioned blood, sweat, and tears being the currency in martial arts, right? So you start martial arts, you begin your journey with your mother that you're continuing with her, which is freaking amazing. Mm-hmm. How quickly does it turn into a profession for you?
I don't know the exact moment the thought occurred to me that this is something I could do for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But I just knew instantly I fell in love with it to a point where I said, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Sure.
I didn't know or cared if it was going to bring me success, money, or accolades or anything. Just being there with the sound of leather hitting leather, the sound of people struggling, this emanating smell of just the sweat and the hard work in there. You look at other people, you know, just going through this battle of attrition of, you know, struggling to get out of a position or move in submission, and they get out and then they attack back. I'm like, this is a whole world that I've missed out on.
Yeah.
You know? So I just know instantly there was just love for the sport. I didn't know that I was going to fight, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know I was also going to teach for a living.
Yeah.
At the time, it's just something that naturally just happened little by little. It, I guess, to answer your question or to give an answer to that, probably started in the hands of someone else. You know, it was going back to my coaches, because we don't see for ourselves what others see. There's a vantage point that your mentors or other people have that we don't.
Mm-hmm.
That's a circumstance of that's a side effect of, you know, not believing in yourself, etc. That's a whole other topic. But my mentors and my coaches thought, they saw in me that I could do something with this, that I had a passion for it. And I think they also saw, not just technically speaking, that this is something I could do, because I wasn't the best at it. I was just wild. Remember, I'm this kid coming from the streets who just like beating up bullies, grew up in East Harlem. I had zero technique. I was just a wild kid and I swung for the fences. I was no technique at all, just crazy and wild. So I don't think they were telling me that I could do something with this, technically speaking. I think they just meant you could do something with this here.
Yes.
Because there's something I see, you just don't know it yet.
Yep.
And fast forwarding through the years of just training every single day, because I loved it, did it every single day. I got my first job working at that school because they wanted, I guess, either not just test me, but to also just give me the keys so that they could leave. Because they're like, dude, this kid never freaking leaves.
He's here till like, you know, midnight. All the time,
just take the keys, clean up, make sure you lock up behind yourself.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful for the trust that they gave me, because it was a gigantic school and just one, it was just me. Some kid they didn't really know, but they knew. You know, I wouldn't take advantage of it.
And getting paid to do that must have been a dream. Like, not felt like work at all, right?
I just loved it. Like, dude, I was scrubbing the showers like overnight. And then by the time the morning instructor had to come in to teach his class. Yeah. He's coming in, see me like in the showers scrubbing. And he's like, dude, what are you doing? You still here? And I was like, yeah. What time is class?
Yeah.
So just fast forwarding through years of that kind of work, the love of it, not for money, not for currency of anything other than blood, sweat, and tears, led my coach to give me my first fight. That, I think, was a transforming moment for me where I said, I could do this. This is something that I do see myself doing.
Did you win your first fight?
Yeah. I was grateful for consecutive 10-0 record. 10th fight was Bellator welterweight champion. So I was crowned a welterweight champion in Bellator. I slept in a cage for 3 months to prepare for that.
Leading up to that fight.
I was going
to
bring that up.
It was, so back then, Bellator was, it was a tournament style. So it was one fight every 30 days.
Okay.
So every month I had to fight back to back. So my coaches were like, all right, well, you need to sleep here then, because that's a lot of training. I want you training 24/7. Like, he was just that, you know, like.
Yeah.
And I didn't second guess them. I didn't ask any questions. I said, all right.
I mean, why would you, when they mentored you so well up until this point and you were following your passion? Like, of course.
Yeah.
Right.
Remember too, I didn't have a father growing up. So I was eating that up. It was my first time experiencing a fatherly figure
pouring into you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
filling that void that I felt my entire life. So I was going to go in whatever direction he was telling me in. So as long as I felt that it was right in my heart, which I did.
Did you latch on to that though? Like that was when like you said earlier, you said you don't know what happiness is or until you experience more. So you were experiencing more than you ever had received from your father. Did you know at the time consciously that that was like you were feeling, you felt that feeling of love and connection, and you were at the time like enthralled by that, and you were like, okay, this is like, this guy's basically a dad to me? Or do you look back now and see that?
I felt right there and then an instant connection
to
not only his tutelage, but to his heartfelt messages to me, because I felt too that it wasn't just about fighting. I wasn't just a workhorse for him, someone who's a prospect that's going to help, you know, build their name and, you know, the Tiger Schulman's brand. It was more of just concern. They were generally always worried. It was just a sense that I felt. I think at first I never trusted people. I never trusted men. I had an experience as a child, you know, of sexual abuse with my own family members. And there was this distrust that I've always had, especially towards men, especially because there was only that spot, although it was filled by someone who was absent in my life, my own father. Still, I'm not sure if this will make sense to you. I would rather have that relationship to avoid, because that was my father, than to try to fill that void with someone else, because at least that void was still my father's, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense.
And so,
yeah. You were come up to Bellator, welterweight, world champ, right? You said 10 fights. Were they all Bellator fights?
No, it was three.
Yeah,
three.
Fights. Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So then at some point, you find yourself in the UFC, right? How did that transition happen from Bellator to UFC?
So after Bellator, I needed, I guess, some more time to get into the UFC. I needed more fights. For whatever reason, you know, not to get political or anything, but there was, you know, I think to be fair, I just needed more fights and I needed to just knock out more people. Although I finished all three people in my Bellator come up to a championship.
You need to body more people in your body of work.
I needed a higher stack of bodies,
I guess.
So needed a 13-second knockout. I needed, you know, to just go out there and just drop people. And so I did. You know, I don't hold the sport or anything against me. You know, at the end of the day, it's a matter of my own performance.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, let's just keep fighting, stay on the track, not get discouraged, you know, disenchanted by the journey. That's part of it. Yeah. God is telling me, you know, just stay the path.
Yeah.
It's not knocking on your door. There, without naming names, there was people that I fought in my past that I know I've beaten who made it into the UFC. And I'm just like, what the f- is going on here? Like, this is. And I was at a point where I'm like, I'm doing all this to just getting these doors slammed on me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the point? You know, I remember I hit a moment too. I'm like, what is the point of all this then?
Yep.
But I said, no, let's keep, you know, carry on.
Yeah.
Carry on. Like, keep your chin up. Just keep plowing through and just keep fighting.
Channeling your love of martial arts, your love of the game, and also probably some things that you had to prove, I would think, or maybe some anger that you haven't yet released, where I'm thinking things that you had to tap into to make sure that you didn't quit in those moments, right? Like when you had that moment, like, what is this all worth? Like, what is this? Why am I doing this? Is this even worth it? I'm assuming that those things came up, not just the positive love that you had for the game, but potentially the negative anger you had or the things you needed to prove to yourself or others in life kept you going, I'm assuming.
So there's a spark and a flame. And I think for me, the spark is my love for the sport.
Mm-hmm.
And the flame is that the worst thing you could say to me is no. Because then I will make it now my mission to prove you wrong. I tell Mika that all the time, my girlfriend. I tell her, the worst thing someone can tell me is no.
Yeah.
As much as it'll be disenchanting or it's a door slam on my face, we're always one no away from a yes.
Yep.
It's just a matter of outlasting the no's until that yes happens, because it will happen. It does for everyone. I think most people just quit too soon and they're only shy of a few no's until they reach that yes.
Yep.
So those are my two things that kept me going during that time. And I was like, listen, keep training, stay in shape, be ready. Because in the sport of MMA, you have to be ready at all times. There's no season.
Yeah.
You know, there's no on and off seasons when it comes to the sport.
Mm-hmm.
I get a call, a 2-week notice fight. Of course, nothing comes easy.
But you're ready.
But I'm ready, you know, and that's ultimately, you know, you talked about it on the show. You said, you know, what success really is just preparation and opportunity meeting, you know, and that is ultimately what happened. You know, I was training. I was already in shape. My love for the sport kept me doing that.
Yep.
And then I just one day got a call from the UFC. They're like, yo, we got this fight out in Cali for you. Someone got hurt. We need a last minute replacement. It was a 2-week notice fight.
Sure.
Let's go.
Yeah.
I went there.
Were you already on weight?
I'm not ever really on weight, let's be honest. Yeah. But to cut weight, yeah. I mean, within the
that window. You know,
the window of no welterweight walks around really at welterweight.
And 2 weeks is about the sweet spot. Like, is that why they, I feel like it's always 2 weeks notice.
Yeah, it's a 2-week mark.
So that's about the point where they're like, okay, you can cut from there.
But bro, I'll suffer whatever it takes for me to make the weight. I've lost as much as like, there was a failed experiment that happened during one of my weight cuts where I had to lose like 19 and a half pounds in the same day, all water.
Whoa.
Like, and then I had to go to the hospital afterwards but still went to the fight. That was actually my 13-second knockout afterwards.
You went to the hospital.
I gotta get this done.
And then still not to do that in 13 seconds. Mm-hmm. Jesus.
Okay.
Yeah, that was back then. It was in Bellator still. Levon Maynard, that fight. Mm-hmm. But anyways, it was just a matter of being just prepared and just ready. I got the call, and then I was fortunate enough, you know, to win that fight. Got my knockout, my first knockout in the UFC. Mm-hmm. You know, and then just went on to keep fighting to present day.
Yep. So now let's bring it to the present. Now you are a sensei. I left that out in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I should have said sensei, teacher. Right. At Tiger Showman's.
Yes.
In Manhattan. So you're teaching, right?
Full time.
You also have Good Theory. Mm-hmm. Right?
Full time.
Full time, right? Full time, right? There's no such thing as part time. Yeah, right? No. So
out of my book.
I want to talk a little bit about Good Theory, what it is, the mission that you're on. Feel free to elaborate on, you know, maybe some of your experiences that drove you to start Good Theory that, you know, we haven't touched on. If you don't want to touch on those, that's fine. We just talk about Good Theory. Because I want the community to be exposed and aware of the good that you're doing for the mental health of others.
So Good Theory was a collaborative effort of myself and my partner. And the culmination of the past 4 years of my life, which is a reflection of the previous decades of my life. Looking back, and to give a short and long answer to that, is Good Theory is an establishment of letting people know that although we tell each other to each other's faces that we are good, you know, the irony of it is my last name. So I'm supposed to be good, that most people truly aren't.
Yeah.
And that in the pursuit of trying to maintain that image in front of others, people live lives of silent desperation. People live in turmoil deep down inside. People silently hurt. Mm-hmm. And people mask that pain away from others so much so that they start to lose sense of who they are. Good Theory is just a way to expose more of the stigmas about that and to talk about, you know, in masculine fields, how important it is to show those parts of us, the broken parts, the not so glamorous parts of us, the parts that are dark, heavy, and deep. That we want to hide from people because we want to seem and appear good in front of others. Mm-hmm. If you research good theory, it's also basically Mika's explanation to it is also it is a formula of everything previous of your past. That based on your past, this is the theory. But it's also a representation of how, despite the past, that should not be also your path in life. Mm-hmm. You are not your past. You are not your feelings. You are not your emotions. We are separate from that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you understand ourselves as human beings, we have so many layers to us. But at the end of the day, pain, the past, all of the hurt does not define who you are. You could always recreate.
Yeah.
And the other slice of the pie of what good theory is to me and the meaning is that I am the third in my lineage. I'm Lyman Good the third. And pain is bestowed onto other people. Hurt is bestowed onto others. As we said before, hurt people hurt people. Mm-hmm. My father passed away 4 years ago, and the vein and the crutch of what has led me to my success in what I do was my relationship to my father. As I said before, that void that mm-hmm. I didn't want anyone to touch, although it was painful for me. Mm-hmm. I also felt an obligation to it, because as an adult, I realize now that if we don't heal ourselves, we bestow that upon to our children and to our future generations. Hurt people, we just continue to hurt more people.
Yeah.
And so despite my father and how, how he was,
mm-hmm.
I look back and I say, he didn't have his father there. So the premise of good theory is basically also a reminder to myself and to others that no matter what kind of lineage you come from, you could always change that, not only for yourself, but for others. But it all starts with you and healing yourself first. Yeah. So we started mental health awareness movement to address that, the stigmas of the mask, the importance of healing yourself, because we all go through traumas. And unless we don't heal it, it's left untouched. Will bleed onto others, mm-hmm. even if they weren't the ones that cut us.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I can do it, I feel like I have a specific vantage point in mental health awareness, because I'm coming from a field where I get my hand raised for knocking out another man, one of the mm-hmm. most male dominant sports that there is. And if in the scope of that, I could speak on behalf of vulnerability and openness, I feel people will listen to that, because sometimes a message, although it is heartfelt and true and honest, it's also a matter of who preaches a message.
Yes.
So that's my mission now in life. Yeah. My partners and I are to go out and just address that.
You're 1,000% correct. You don't need me to tell you that, but who you are, what you've been through, what you've accomplished positions you perfectly to heal others, right? Your journey has been of hurt, right? What was done unto you and what you've done unto others, hurt in different ways. And you've began a healing journey of yourself, and you're making sure that you are passing on that healing, not that pain, to others and helping them heal themselves. And they will pay that forward. And that's one of the beautiful things that I think of when I hear about good theory. The crest, it looks like a crest that appears on some of your good theory apparel, right?
Uh-huh.
Is that a representation of you being the third Lyman Good and you breaking the cycle that preceded you in those generations?
You hit it on the head with that. It's a nod to family, that although family may be imperfect,
mm-hmm.
carry on the name and let it stand for something new, change.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than just abandoning ship and like, oh, I'm going to start new and create this new family, like pretend like everything in my previous, lineage mm-hmm. in my blood, it's literally in my veins.
Yep.
Let's pretend I never existed. Rather than doing that, carry on with the name, but just change what it stands for.
Of course.
Carry the crest.
Yep.
But change, like, who yields that crest,
I see that coming through in not only the content that you both put out, but I see it coming through in the products that you create for the people that resonate with that movement, that are healing themselves and allowing themselves to be vulnerable, really, like you are. You're such a good example of that. And I've told you that personally. The irony of vulnerability is that, and I'm speaking on something that I'm still learning, right, with vulnerability, but the irony that I see in vulnerability is that everybody perceives it as weakness, but it's actually strength.
Yeah.
That's the irony of this whole thing. People don't want to show up in a room and be vulnerable because they don't want to be perceived as weak. But as soon as they do it, they become a pillar of strength for everybody around them because they had the courage to step forward and say, this is how I'm feeling. I'm not good in some instances. That's
why those who heal have an obligation twice, one to themselves and one to others. When you heal yourself, you've done one of your two duties. One is to yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that now that you carry, we talked about the hero's journey. In the hero's journey, if any of you research it and read up on the circle of it, the cycle of the hero's journey is is that you leave the story with some form of antidote, like some form of
elixir
of life. That now you go back into the world to help others, to help them, to free them.
Yeah.
It's like you talked about The Matrix being one of our favorite movies.
Yep.
You know, the ones that are still stuck in the Matrix, but then you have your you know, the renegades, people that have escaped.
Yeah.
They don't escape and leave. They escape, build a community to go back in and unplug others exactly. that are ready to be unplugged.
Exactly.
But in this world, I feel my life, this life that I'm living now is now my duty is, although I'm still healing,
mm-hmm.
is that now I can see things in a different color, in a different shade, in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the two of you, when I see you, I see that it's right at your doorstep, wanting to mm-hmm. talk and open up about things. We were talking before
yep.
about personal things
mm-hmm.
that I see
yeah.
and identify. I can identify with your pain because mm-hmm. I feel your pain and I feel yep. yours and I see it. It's not for me to force it out, but it's mm-hmm. for me to at least talk and to let you know, hey, Joey,
yep.
where I am is where you mm-hmm. want to be, and it's okay. It's okay yeah. to open up and talk.
Yeah,
Drew,
yeah.
like what you've went through,
mm-hmm.
I've experienced that, and it's okay.
Yeah.
What's on the other side of that is much better than where you feel you are now.
Sure.
That is now my duty to give onto yeah. this world now, you know.
Yep, and you're doing an excellent job. There's so much synergy between what you're doing with Good Theory and what we're doing with Fuel Hunt. Like, you know, I don't ever think that you're healed. You said, I'm still healing. I yeah. think we all are,
yeah.
right? I don't know if you're ever fully healed. I think there's vigilance that always has to be there because those habits that were formed during the hurt can always creep back in,
yeah.
I feel like. So the healing needs to be a continuous process with your vigilant
yeah,
during.
I feel like there's, in life, there's no getting rid of the weight. There's just your muscles becoming strong enough and stronger under that weight to make that weight feel from like it's super heavy to just something that you just have to hold and it's light. But you always carry it. It's a burden for yours. It's a burden of yours for the rest of your life because there's just some things that will always be there.
Mm-hmm.
There's just pain and experiences and things that I've experienced as a child that I can't go back in time.
Yeah.
You know, it's a change. But to be fair, would I be the person I am today if it wasn't for that also, you know?
Exactly.
Good Theory wouldn't have come about if, you know, 4 years ago, my world completely flipped upside down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in spite of Good being my last name, I've hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
I've done bad things and I've hurt others who didn't deserve it also. And
that was your... That was the version of you that was hurt and not as healed as you are today that did that.
Yeah.
But now you're, you know?
I think too, it's funny because I spent about a good 18 years standing on the other side of a lens, being this avatar and this character of strong, you know, and it's to say that to a degree, you know, to an extent, or in a certain way, yeah, strength, of mm-hmm. course, because it takes strength to do what we do and to continue and plow forward. But there was also a side of it that felt like I wasn't really getting my real message out for 18 years.
That thing inside
you. Yeah, that still. Inner child, bro. There's an inner child in us. And, you know, it's tough because you have to balance it out too. I don't want to preach about mental health and get into this whole other side of it that can get very dark also and can get to a point where it's like, all right, all we're doing is just, you know, like just looking back at things that you can't change anymore. So I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm not on the other side of it too, where it's like, all right, let's just sit down, let's kumbaya, run a fire and just like cry for the rest of our lives.
Sure.
But there's a side of it where you have to stop, slow down, embrace the inner child, let them be heard and felt and seen, whatever that means to the person or to you.
Yeah.
But also move forward, because the man that is there now is waiting for you. There's a man waiting on the other side of that healing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, you know, as Bedros Kooling says, that 2.0 version of you, you know,
your future self. Yeah.
I've stood in front of a lens for 18 years and I've never really felt like I've made a difference until the past year. Really. It's, I'll be honest, it's been only 1 year that I've been talking more like this into a mic. Not easy still. I'm not, you know, I still flinch and there's parts of me that's fighting it. Like, you know, shut the fuck up. Like, you know, what are you doing? Stop. Like,
yeah.
But I've connected more with people in the past year of this campaign of honesty and vulnerability than I have of just trying to always be strong in front of people.
Yeah.
My relationship to my sister, I have two sisters, and one of them, we weren't necessarily the closest, but I've also tried to maintain an integrity of being an example to her. I felt that was always my duty to my two sisters because I helped my mom raise them when they were younger. And I said, well, I also have an obligation to, you know, two little girls growing up in this world without a father. So here I am. Let's man the fuck up. Let's be a father to them.
Mm-hmm.
But all that really did was made us more distant as the years went by. And I didn't notice, I didn't realize this until the past few years.
Yeah.
My sister once said to me, and it was through messages recently, a couple of years back, saying that this is the closest I felt to you. Because you're not trying to be perfect. You're not trying to be this image or this thing that I can never be.
Yep.
You know, and she said, I'll never forget. I never wanted Superman as my brother. And I was like, wow, I've been going about it wrong this whole time.
Yeah.
And I let her in for the past 4 years. You know, I know we're kind of skimming over things, but
that's okay.
If you really want to get more deep into it, it's just been 4 years of alcoholism, abuse, ironically enough, getting put back into a psychiatric unit, which I did, you know, a couple of years ago. Self-inflicted harm, hurting other people, doing very dangerous things to myself, literally trying to give God the wheel. Mm-hmm. You can read in between the lines on what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
If you combine alcohol and certain things. Everything that wanted to fall apart since I was 9 years old until 4 years back fell apart.
Yeah.
And I think that was the start of my healing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other thing we don't talk about in mental health is silence. And silence is a side effect of trying to be strong for others because we have to stay silent.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a burden we had to carry all the time.
Yeah. Well, silent no more. And that's evident. I mean, your journey from hurt to healing has been one that's been complex. You've walked, it sounds like, the path of hitting rock bottom more than once, it seems, right?
Yeah.
But as I know you now, as a friend in the past year or so, all I see is healing and you giving the gifts of your growth to others. So for me, what I can see from externally, right, it seems like good theory is going to be exactly what you both want it to be, and it's going to help heal more people than I believe you think it will at this very moment.
So, I hope so.
Yeah.
I think that is plan, the mission,
yeah,
you know, our duty. I'm grateful to have a partner in Mika who is literally there as the chaos unfolded in my life, mm-hmm. and she allowed me to heal. She's been a big part of that as well, because she experienced a journey and she's seen one of the ugliest parts of me. Mm-hmm. And I've, in all of my experience and in most men's experience, we've met our significant others always in our best moments, you know, our most shining, you know, moments of shining armor in front of people.
Yeah.
But, man, I got rid of that armor very fast 4 years ago and showed the ugliest parts of me and allowed myself to be vulnerable in front of her. And I think that's also what gave me the courage to be vulnerable in front of others.
Sure.
I think combination of that and just that I also am not perfect. I'm not someone who's trying to be in front of a camera now and like, I'm on this campaign of healing. I'm doing great. I'm good. I'm this good person. I'm mm-hmm. far from that.
Yeah.
I think part of it is to relinquish the sense of weight on myself to, you know, I don't know if people, you know, think or believe like I'm trying to be that person, but I'm not. I'm far from it. As a matter of fact, I'm so imperfect. I'm so contradicting to what it may seem on a camera. And I think most of us are, to be fair, because it's such bullshit. A lot of what's put out there on social media and everything.
Yep.
But the moments you do see of me, what I put out is honest. Those are moments, but those aren't moments that just define who I am as a person. Yep. And I think that's to be said about everybody. We all have parts of us that we hide away, but those parts, whether you hide it from people or not, that's on you, but don't hide it from yourself.
Yeah.
Look at the man in the mirror, see what's there, encounter the darkness and walk through it. Because in that darkness, there's the parts of you that have yet to be touched that are so cold. There's like this little freaking child version of yourself in a corner in the dark somewhere, just waiting to be healed so that the adult you, the version, you know, the future you can move forward.
For sure. Yeah, in some ways that child that you find in that dark cave that you heal in a way takes your hand and then leads you to that future self, that other man, right? Yeah. That you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, you have to do the work. At the end of the day, there's no magic remedy or secret, you know, pill or anything. It's just you gotta do the work.
And that's why we're passionate about it. You know, it's not just to build a life or build a thing, a business or whatever that you're proud of, that you can provide for your family. It's also to build yourself. And that's what it's been about for us at Fuel Hunt. And same with Good Theory, like since day one. You know, the more that we expose our dark corners and show everybody that we have the courage to do that and do the hard work to continue march towards the light, the more people will join the community and do the same thing, you know? So
I think what you guys are doing is amazing. One of the things that to me resonates, I know hunt is a very powerful word. I'm very like, I think prolifically there's just words or totem images or animals, like things like that stand out. But one that stands out is few.
Yeah.
Because there's a scarcity in life, that in that scarcity lies the antidote, the elixir, the answer, the solution.
Yep.
And as much as we live in a world where all we glorify is a problem, amongst the few will be the ones to find also the solution if they're willing to put in the work.
You know? Yeah.
You have to be willing to do the work. There's a lot of inner work that needs to be done. There's a lot of outer work, because as much as you're healing, going through all this, you still have families to take care of. You still have people just kind of waiting there, be like, all right, when is my father going to arrive? When am I going to have a dad?
Sure.
When am I going to have, you know, my husband, my partner?
Yeah.
Whatever relationship you fulfill and you know your dynamic, that person who's there on the receiving end is waiting for you to arrive.
We had a conversation earlier about the few, and Drew was joking with me because I love that the words the few, I just love it, because it embodies like who we are, who everyone in your movement is and who everybody in our movement is and our communities, like the few that are going to do the work to move us all forward, you know? And it doesn't come from a place of perfection. It comes from a place of progress. Like, we're not perfect, but we're going to do the work and we're going to make sure there's progress. So we celebrate everything you're doing with Good Theory. The Good Theory's community members are the few, and we're synergistic, you know what I mean? Like our community members are your community members. And why don't you tell everybody where, so we can bring this in for a bit of a landing. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find Good Theory and how to join your community? And then if you do want to also touch on, I know you had some news recently with your app that you launched, if you want to touch on that too. So sure. Let them know where they can find you as well. Like, you know, just tell everybody where they can get all this goodness.
So on our website, goodtheorywellness.com. You can find us on our socials, good.theory. We've also attached, mine is always just about Good Theory. So you can look up my personal one at Lyman Good MMA. We are right now in the process of closing up our online fitness app that we're going to launch. And it's to address the importance of, you know, all this we talked about was more like internals, the mind, the heart, et cetera. But fitness plays such a key role in healing. So the online fitness app is to address the fitness side of things. The better in shape you are, the better of a human being you become as well, whether it's through martial arts or exercise, whatever you do, as long as you do something.
Yep.
In any case, we're going to be launching that as well. The website for that is goodtheorycoaching.com, but you'll see the links for it all over the Instagram socials for Good Theory, both on the website and on the Instagram.
Very good. Yeah, it goes back to the weight that you were talking about, you know, and it's such a great metaphor, like carrying the weight that we have, and the stronger that you are physically to carry physical weight, the stronger you are to carry, you know, that internal weight as well. So I love what you're doing, all facets of it. And I really appreciate you making the trek down today. And just to echo what you said in the beginning of the show, man, I value your friendship so much.
I appreciate it. Appreciate the love that you guys are showing to me and everything you do. I firmly believe in you guys and what you're doing. It's not just the message, but the humans behind it. And also the, you know, I'm also excited for what's to come. Not just for the brand, but for you both individually. Because the more I talk to you, the more I see you.
Yeah.
And I know there's something there and it'll come out soon when it's ready.
Yeah.
I know you got a lot to offer still to this world. So congrats ahead of time for that. And, you know, happy to be part of this as well. So thank you for having me.
Thank you, man. Thank you, man. All right, we're going to bring this in for a landing. Any closing thoughts?
No, I sat here the whole time just like, I like the way Lyman
speaks. The few are going to go back through this multiple times and listen to it. And listen to it because there's multiple messages that we all need to hear. Even if we've heard them before, we need to hear them again. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm going to leave the few with our sign off. A reminder, always choose hard work over handouts. Always choose effort over entitlement. No one owns you. No one owes you. You're one of the few. Well, Tom.
Let's go.